Thanks very much, Gene. And it's a pleasure to have you all in the Big Apple. And this has been a really great weekend. It's been a year in the making. And what better way to cap it all off than with our banquet speaker, Professor Richard Epstein. Professor Epstein, after this weekend, I don't think I need to really introduce Professor Epstein. He's been a constant presence both at the symposium, on social media, but really he's been a constant presence in this organization and for all of us in the conservative legal movement. I know as a 1L opening up basically any of my 1L textbooks, I was sure to read something that Professor Epstein wrote, and maybe even had a textbook authored by him. And to have him here and to keynote this banquet is just really a capstone as a 3L to sort of the ideas that he inspired us all to believe in, the sort of encouragement, even when our own faculty may not espouse the ideas that we hold dear. We had Professor Epstein always pushing the ideological envelope and always having our back, so to say. And with that, I would love to welcome Richard Epstein up to the stage.
I don't have a glass of water. Look, it's really a very great honor to be here. And as I begin, let me first add my thanks to Will Bode. I have a special reason to thank him. When I'm at the University of Chicago, my office is next door to his. He's sitting next to Ms. Grant, who's my Roman law student, right? And so we have there, sitting next to McConnell and Otis, who are former students of mine, so I feel as though I'm very much at home. And the thing to say about Will is it's not only that he educates his students, he also educates his elders, folks like myself. Going into his office with this pile of books, my first thing is to take one that I've written, which is on the bottom of the stack, and move it to the top, just so that he won't forget that I'm there. And then it's like a clinic, listening him to talk about things. He's not only a librarian, but it turns out his comprehensive knowledge is truly awe-inspiring, and I'm very much in his intellectual debt, as I am for so many other people in this room. Now, I'm talking today, I guess, about a topic which is supposed to be benign, but is in fact deeply subversive. And the title of the talk that I gave, if only to myself, was A Common Law of the First Amendment. What could possibly be more innocent than that? But this title was in fact patterned on a talk that I gave at the Yale Law School in 1983 when I was invited by a member of the then nascent Federal Society named Eugene Olofsky, who calls me up and he says, the Federalist Society has been allocated a single spot at the two-day convention on the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the New Deal, and we'd wonder whether you would have enough temerity in order to come and to fill it. And my answer to him was, only, I'm perfectly happy to do it, even to pay my own way if necessary, given what the founding fathers of the Yale Law School think. And I gave a talk on the common law for labor relations, which provoked a near riot on the part of many people who were in the room, and for good reason. What happened was I had taken labor law from a man named Harry Wellington, who was a fine teacher and a good New Deal accommodationist, which meant, in effect, that you took every major premise as settled and spent your time arguing how you implement the fundamental principles of the National Labor Relations Act and similar statutes, and whether you did it through a board or through an arbitration proceedings or through a private tort action or whatever. And I sat in the class and saying, you never asked the right question, which is whether or not you ought to blow this thing entirely up and start over. So when I come back to the Yale Law School in 1983, I decide to have my revenge, and I will talk about what the labor law will look like if you have a common law approach with respect to the subject matter. And this will actually relate to freedom of speech, and I hope to explain why. Well, the first thing what you do is, if you're a good common lawyer, generally you think that coercion is bad and that contract is good. And so you have as your first proposition that no person ought to be forced to enter into a contract with somebody else unless you fell within a narrow common carrier situation. And standard competitive firms are not common carriers. So the 1908 and 1915 decisions in Adair and Coppedge v. Kansas, respectfully, are not ancient curiosities, but they represent a very sound rule when they struck down collective bargaining statute. And then it turns out, if it turns out that these people cannot force arrangements, inducement to breach of contract is a traditional tort. And shortly thereafter, if you ask workers on a job who are not union members to come out in unison when called, it's inducement to breach of contract, which is tortious, and you can enjoin them and hold them responsible. Now, these are positions which are the articles of faith of a very tiny minority of people then and now, and they were completely dashed with the New Deal in the period between 1932 and about 1940. And so if I was right, the National Labor Relations Act, the Norris LaGuardia Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, these all go the way of all flesh and have to be struck down. And you could imagine what the response was to that at this particular New Deal celebration. It was not positive, but I managed to survive the day and to have the great virtue of remaining an academic forever, because once you announce that you believe in the Yellow Dog contract as the highest expression of individual liberty, your life as a public servant is forever over, which is just fine with me. It's more fun to be a critic than it is to be an apparatchik, as far as I am concerned. So the question then is, well, how does that relate to the topic that I'm supposed to speak to you now? And well, if you start listening to what I said, what were the kinds of things that you were prepared to find tortious? Inducement of breach of contract. Well, that involves speech, right? And then the question is, well, if it involves speech, why is it not protected by a clause which starts to deal with the freedom of speech? And then if it turns out you look at contracts and I say, I refuse to deal with you, that's also speech. And why in a term is that not going to be protected? So what we have is this puzzle. They're getting it exactly backwards. Those things which are tortious are now protected, and those things which are contractual are now attacked. The shift from the older system to the newer system is not just some marginal error being corrected. It's a fundamental inversion of basic relationships. It's like setting a ship which is sailing north and turning it around and sailing it south and saying we haven't done anything except a modest course correction. Well, once you understand this, what then becomes from this? Well, the first thing you realize is that if you're going to try to analyze anything having to do with freedom of speech, you cannot silo speech from other forms of conduct with which it's related. And if you listen to many of the remarks that were made at the conference in the last 2 days, there was always the question, is this a pure speech thing, a part speech thing, another kind of speech thing? And what happens is you're desperately trying to figure out how to draw boundary lines, most of which, as a matter of general theory, don't work. And what's characteristic of the common lawyers is that they never thought that there were separate amendments with different standards of review. They had a comprehensive view of the world, which essentially talked about what's good in voluntary arrangements and what's bad in coercion. And then what you try to do is to figure out what counts as conversion or as coercion. And if you get the correct definitions on this, this is the way in which it starts to work. Coercion involves the use of force, and everybody understands that force is not speech. But coercion also involves the threat of the use of force, and no matter how clever you are about the way in which you look at the system, it's going to be very difficult for you to come up and to say that a threat of one kind or another, by words or I dare say by gesture, it really doesn't matter for these purposes, is somehow or other in a different moral realm than is the actual coercive behavior. Well, at this particular point, there is, as a matter of common law, no fundamental distinction between conduct on the one hand and speech on the other hand. The question is, why do you think these things are good or bad? Well, let's begin with a very naive premise, which is, generally speaking, people know their own self-interest. And so if they decide to do a particular action, the reason why we favor freedom for them is we now know that somebody is better off, and we don't have any information yet as to whether or not, either episodically or systematically, anybody else is worse off. And so you can call this a Pareto improvement, to be very clever about it. And generally speaking, the older I get, the harder it is to find an objection to the proposition. I figured out a way to make somebody better off in his own life and not make anybody else worse off in their own lives, but nonetheless, it's immoral because. It's very difficult to figure out what the Trump is if you define self-interest in a sufficiently broad way. But this does not mean that we believe that liberty and license are the same things, because there always are externalities. Now, these externalities are of two sorts. There are some which are positive, which are extremely important, and I'll talk about them maybe a little, but that's not the essence of this talk. When you're talking about the state, the first business isn't to subsidize positive externalities. Your first business is to make sure that negative externalities are going to be effectively controlled and suitably defined. And so what the libertarian says, and says rightly, is the use or threat of force is in fact not to be protected as a part of liberty, because if systematically engaged in by all persons against all other persons, this turns out to be the war of all against all, in which nobody is better off, everybody else is worse off. This is not a very difficult empirical judgment. And so what you have done, therefore, is to now have a way in which certain forms of speech and certain forms of conduct are going to be equally prescribed. So you have here a kind of nice view of what it is that we're dealing with. Now, it turns out that anybody who does libertarian theory realizes that force has a kid brother, and the kid brother turns out to be some form of misrepresentation. We talk about force and fraud. And again, it takes a great genius to figure out why fraudulent speech or fraudulent conduct is in fact to be regarded as something other than speech when it's clearly speech. And yet nobody would want to say that these things are appropriate, because one of the major agencies associated with speech is as follows. If I can talk to you and lie to you and get you to give something, then I don't have to threaten you. And by and large, threatening people is more dangerous than lying to people. So I'd rather use the subtle technique and hold the force back to the cases where I really need it. And we kind of understand that you're not allowed to do this. It also turns out that if you're talking about the really deadly forms of speech, many of them in the form of misrepresentations about A to B, which is part of a very early body of law known as the law of defamation. And it means essentially, as I say something false to somebody and he doesn't do business with a third person, you can really make this into an enormous norm in which there's a massive amount of harm. And it also relates to force, because there's also a tort known as interference of prospective advantage by the use of force, so that if I shoot a gun at your potential customers and they run away, it's not only a tort against the persons who were assaulted, it's an interference with advantageous relationship, and defamation should be regarded as a kind of a kid's sister with respect to that as well. So if you put these things together, what you do now is you sort of have a very good first approximation about the kinds of things that we would generally want to regard as wrong. And we have done so without invoking any kind of general constitutional doctrine. But it turns out that the law is much more complicated than this. And as you understand what the nature of the difficulties are with respect to the common law, you can then see how they transform almost isomorphically to modern constitutional law. The model that I have talked about here essentially has omitted a couple of very important questions which have to be added back into the equation. Sometimes you do one of these things, you use a threatened force, and you could be justified under these circumstances. Sometimes you lie, and you could be justified in doing that. Now, there are people who want to deny this. One of the most famous illustrations by Immanuel Kant, which basically relegates him to the world of insane philosophers on a bad day, was that if somebody comes into your house and asks the whereabouts of your children so that he can murder him, You may remain silent, but you may not lie in order to throw him off the scent. And people said, was it senility or stupidity that drove this particular situation? But I've seen modern philosophers say the same kind of thing in the Kantian tradition. But virtually everybody understands that whenever you have prima facie cases, there are going to be justifications or excuses that can be given to them. If you now think of the Constitution as creating a set of prima facie cases, prima facie you're allowed to talk, and then you can overcome that by showing force or fraud, then you're going to allow for justifications. And it turns out, I don't care how much of a textualist Mr. Will Bode is, or anybody else, sooner or later, the issue of how it is that you introduce justifications and start to deal with them is going to be a central part of your overall kind of system. Which means, in effect, that textualism, properly understood, is a constitutional norm that answers a few questions directly and then invites you to develop a comprehensive theory of liability, excuses, and justifications. If you go back and you're a good common law pleader, you know that confession and avoidance doesn't end everything. There are exceptions to this and exceptions to that. And by the time you're done, if you've ever looked at any ancient text and then start looking at the Constitution, what starts out as a tiny provision, Miss Grant, ends up as the Lex Aquila, if you recall, right? And it turns out one sentence gets 55 pages of detailed exposition. And if you start looking at it, you realize they can't avoid any of the questions that they raise. Modern American constitutional law raises exactly the same kind of issues. So we then start to push ahead a little bit further and say, what else is there about common law that you have to do after you've gone through this elaborate situation of prima facie case justifications, exceptions, and so forth? You have to think about how the law of remedies works under these circumstances. And us good libertarians tend to start the analysis in the ex post world where a single discrete action has taken place and the only question is rectification for past harms. And that was the model that Aristotle put forward when he talked about corrective justice in, I think it was, the Ethics, but it may have been the Politics, who cares? So it turns out there's one serious problem with this particular analysis. Actually, many serious problems. Let's just start with the first one, is that legal systems, in effect, have to deal with this difficult problem known as uncertainty. And that sometimes you have actions that are in the making which may or may not turn out to be harmful. And you have to decide whether you're going to give an ex ante remedy on the one hand or an ex post remedy on the other, or some combination as between the two. If you then break both of the halves down, it turns out that the ex ante remedies are extremely complicated. They can have temporal components to them. They can have conditions associated with them. They can involve third parties that may be involved. If you then try to do the ex post world, it could be expectation damages, reliance damages, a fine of one kind or another. And you have to answer this particular question, but you can stare at the constitutional text as long as you want, and you will discover there's not a word which starts to deal with the way in which you face these remedial issues. And as good First Amendment lawyers, we start hearing that you don't allow prior restraint, except in the cases when you do, and then you have to figure out why the presumption is one way rather than the other. And essentially what the rule is exactly the same as courts of equity developed a long time ago, which is by and large, you wait as long as you can, most of the time, before you issue an injunction until the time of imminent peril, because otherwise what you do is you manage to shut down too much innocent activity. And exactly the same kind of choice advises in all sorts of issues. So if you go back to one of the famous English cases, Tuberville and Stamp, the question is, if somebody said, I would strike you if it were not assize time, can you hit him? Because if you wait, as the judges say, it may be too late. And then when you get to modern cases, this is no different from the issue that you face in a case like Abrams and Schenck and Dennis, where these guys are starting to talk about things, they seem kind of bad, they may be doing something harmful. Can you or can you not punish them before the act, or must you wait afterwards? It turns out with certain things like conspiracy, you can do it beforehand. And one of the things I always like to say about the great Brandeis dissent in Whitney against California is it wasn't a dissent. It was a concurrence. He was prepared to throw these guys in the slammer because they had a conspiracy with a particular end, and nobody can tell me that a conspiracy, in some sense, is not a form of speech. The externalities are negative, so we punish it. If it's an ordinary partnership, its externalities are positive, so we, in fact, enforce it. So what's going on in this particular case? It just turns out that the interpretive commitments that we make to a particular constitution require us to go back and replicate as a constitutional matter all of the kinds of disputes that we have to resolve in ordinary private law disputes. And it also turns out in the private law disputes, the more complicated the case, the more contested the remedies and the more difficult the choice. And so if you follow the model that I'm talking about here, you can now understand why in many situations, as you get yourself into the constitutional law, you quickly end up into the constitutional thicket. The question is whether or not this is fatal to the rule of law is one of the questions that you want to answer. And the answer to that question is no. And the reason why the answer is no is that as you start to look at complicated variations on any doctrine, the first thing you must always ask is what's the frequency of occurrence of the difficult problems that we could phrase in the abstract. And in one of my sort of eureka moments in law school, I was sitting in a class on civil procedure with the late Fleming James, who was a tort professor, and I had just gone through my English experience reading all of the variations in HLA Hart on honore on causation in the law, and Fleming James, an old railroad lawyer, starts talking about proximate cause, and he says, you know what this stuff is about? Somebody ramming into somebody else. And if 98% of the cases turn out to be like that, the Paul Grass variation having to do with setting on fire explosives and things of the sort, you can have contest on low frequency issues that are difficult to resolve by courts so long as you get the easy cases right on both sides of the line. And so doctrinal complexity is not necessarily a sign that the entire system will necessarily break down and fall apart. So having done this particular common law type situation, what you then want to do is to start looking at some constitutional doctrines, and I don't know how many minutes I will be given by Gene, but when he gives me the axe, I'll just stop in mid-sentence. You want to sort of see how they square up, and sure enough, what happens is you look at these things, you see all the common law problems coming back again. You see cases of defamation arising, cases of intentional infliction of emotional distress, cases of fraudulent behavior against third parties, cases of God knows what kind of uncertainties that you have in other kinds of business arrangements. How do the cases treat them and what? Well, let me go down to a couple of them. The first one that I think is supremely important is one that was talked about many times in the conference and we can never ignore. And it's the relationship between the law of defamation on the one hand and the law of personal offense on the other hand. And this is the way I think one has to deal with it. As I said last night, and I don't want to dwell on it again, I thought that New York Times against Sullivan was a terrible mistake to the extent that it abandoned the earlier common law decisions by making actual liability turn on malice. If one follows the arc of cases since that time, there was huge litigation over this particular issue and all its variations from about 1964 to about 1990, and then it just drops like a stone. What happened is every serious media plaintiff knew that if you tried to sue, by the time you were done, you were worse off suing than sort of licking your wounds and going off, and so there are no cases. The absolute malice or the actual malice test became de facto an absolute bar. Well, what does this do? It makes sure that people now have a free season on public officials. And if you want to intensify your criticism, you can do so pretty much without any kind of legal redress. There is count the street, but the last thing we want to do is have screaming on both sides of the issue. And so what the legal system does by removing a standard restraint is it encourages various kinds of extreme behavior, which goes against one of the themes that we had at this conference, namely the theme associated with civility. But the greater danger comes from the second half of this, and that's the material that's associated with the principle of offense and the principle of the heckler's veto. And I take my key on this particular point from what I thought was an extremely prescient sentence by Justice Rehnquist, Chief Justice Rehnquist, in a 2000 case called Dale against the Civil Rights Commission, or whatever they call them. They're called human rights. It doesn't matter. In New Jersey, in which the issue was whether or not the Boy Scouts, which had a preference at the time not to admit gay members, were entitled to have it. And Justice Stevens, in one of the great miscalculations, announced that if it's a really intense preference, then I'm willing to expect it. But if it's just a mild preference and there's a lot of difference, I don't have to do it. Well, what happens is this is an open invitation for anybody who wants to disagree with somebody to realize if they just disagree, they can't change anything. But if they get themselves up into a white lather, now all of a sudden they've got themselves some kind of a powerful entitlement. And the last thing that you want to do in any legal circumstances is to privilege the kind of extreme behavior that takes place by giving it a purchase on the conduct of other individuals. And all of the stuff that the First Amendment says about the heckler's veto tends to worry, for the most part, in traditional analysis, about the immediate circumstance in which one guy is not allowed to shout down another. But the long-term insidious behavior is with the incentives that it creates for people to engage in that. And so the correct answer in these cases is the one that Professor McConnell said earlier on, is you try your damnedest to stop those people who are engaged in the wrong, rather than forcing people who are engaged in permissible speech conduct to surrender on the other side. And if you put together these two mistakes, both of which are inconsistent with common law principles, it turns out you have a fair bit of what's going on to explain what's worked in these particular circumstances. Now, to take another kind of variation, let's start looking at the fraud side of this for a second, and then I'll turn a little bit to the remedial side of it. And the case I want to talk about here is a case called Alvarez against the United States, having to do with something known as the Stolen Valor Act. And what this is a situation well documented by Justice Alito in his dissent, where what he does is he shows that there are all sorts of people who go around and find some way to prevent that they're generals in somebody's army in order to get themselves some political preferment. And in fact, some of them simply go the whole nine yards and say, oh, I am a Medal of Honor recipient. And no private party is generally in a position to chase after these people for the usual reasons of class actions and similar problems. Anybody who hears this stuff is going to be hurt only a little bit. Why would they take the whole cost of a lawsuit to protect other individuals? It makes no sense. When you talk about consumer fraud statutes, generally speaking, the argument has always been that the state can intervene so as to make sure from the ex-ante provision, if this is a pervasive risk, that it doesn't happen. And if you have that as an incentive, knowing the government's going to come after you, the frequency will start to go down, the prosecutions will become more coherent. You don't have a real problem with respect to overbreath because you're not stopping people before they speak. They actually have to commit the thing which, if said to another individual, would be actionable fraud. And the geniuses on the United States Supreme Court found a whole variety of reasons, basically sophistical, to announce that this really wasn't the situation. So what do we have when we look at this? What you do is you now have a doctrine with respect to these kinds of cases, which essentially licenses fraud by preparing or refusing to provide the standard sorts of remedies that take place. I cannot think of any reason why it is that if you're a libertarian, you would believe in that. As a libertarian, you believe in the control of fraud. And at this particular point, it's an instrumental question of whether you control it by private rights of action or public rights of action. You ask about the overbreath problem. That doesn't seem to be an issue here. It's yet another interest where it turns out they get it wrong. Now, a third illustration about this has to do with the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress, which was something in the Snyder case associated with the Westboro Church, in which these guys sort of had a habit of holding demonstrations around gay funerals in an effort to create maximum distress with respect to family. And I think the basic line that made that case work was the dissent that was taken by Justice Alito in his concurrence, and he said, look, if it turns out that these guys are 1,000 feet away and you just get upset because it turns out that you're upset that they're there, I'm not going to give you any protection. But if they actually come close enough to your face so as to make it appear as a taunt and an insult, then I'll protect you. That's exactly the common law rule with respect to intentional infliction of emotional distress. And it's a very accurate guide as to why, in that case, they get away with terrible behavior, subject only to social sanctions, but they don't do it in the other case. And if you want to extend the protection beyond all of that, then it seems to me you have exactly the same problem you have everywhere else. If you know what the common law of tort starts to look like, then in effect you don't want the constitutional law to expand the freedom to commit actions that would otherwise be tortious. And the last case I'm going to talk, because we're certainly coming close to the end, is a situation having to deal with the question of picketing and abortion. It's a case about Ms. Coakley and McKevin or some such person. And what the state of Massachusetts does is it says, we have entrances to abortion clinics, and these things are like funnels. You have to go through them to get where you want to be. It turns out, for the sake of argument, you have to accept, as I do not, but you have to accept, that abortion is a fundamental right protected by Roe v. Wade, and that the people who want to get these abortions are fully entitled to protection. And then the question is, what happens when other people want to block their ingress or egress from these particular situations with what they regard as benevolent motives, to warn the women of the dangers of the procedures that are likely to take place with respect to them, and to urge them to reconsider? And the old rule said you could get within 6 feet and do this. That's close enough to grant. And so what the state legislature did in a remarkably intelligent and therefore unconstitutional matter was it decided that 35 feet was the appropriate distance. Now, the first thing you do whenever you see a statute which has a foot number in there, you want to think about, is it arbitrary or not? And if it was 6 miles, you'd say, can't do that. If it was 4 inches, you couldn't. Why 35 feet? Well, the basic judgment you're making is you're close enough to be heard, but you're not close enough to threaten. And so if you have that particular line, they can get their message across, but they can't do coercion. If you go back to every picketing case in the United States, starting with Voegelin and Gunter, a famous labor case of Justice Holmes in 1896, it turns out sorting out speech from coercion is what you're about. And now you've got an intelligent statute that wants to do this. And what does the Supreme Court say? It says that we prefer case-by-case judgments on these kinds of things. And all that does is introduce a massive amount of uncertainty about facts and circumstances, which means that you can't do anything ex ante in the way in which you set up the picket lines. And what you have to do is to deal with tumult and confusion that takes place otherwise. So I have been criticized for my views on this on the ground that abortion is murder. My view is that's the question to revisit Roe v. Wade, true or false. But the key point to understand in constitutional adjudication is that when you're dealing with an issue of instrumentation and implementation, as you are here, you have to take the substantive law as given and then ask this exact question you ask about all remedies, whether it's too broad on the one hand or too narrow on the other. The presumption is in favor of the state if they could come up with a sensible set of arguments, which in this case, then they do. So if you put this all together, what's interesting about it is that we deviate from all of the common law rules in a whole variety of ways. Sometimes it's too speech protective, sometimes we're not protective enough. But if you actually run the comparisons, I think in virtually every one of these cases, if you take a larger normative view, you're going to come up with the view that the common law rules actually outperform the constitutional rules, and that what you then have to do is to figure out what's the mistake. And the mistake is basically this. If you're a common lawyer, you're just trying to figure out how it is that you resolve these private disputes and minimize errors, and you don't have any red flags there. But if you become an American constitutional lawyer, all of a sudden, you don't worry about the merits of a case. You worry about standards of review, which clause, preferred freedoms, and all of that clutter which gets away in sensible judgment. So my principle, not as radical here as it is in the labor cases, but born of the same fruit, is simply this. You can't do constitutional law unless you know common law, and you guys don't get caught common law except by people like Will Bode and Michael McConnell. So thank you for listening, and I'm willing to take questions. Some brave soul?
Does anyone have questions?
That's what I like. 400 people interested in free debate.
I found one.
Oh, good. Who's the brave soul? Well, you're wrong.
Professor Epstein, thank you very much for coming. I was wondering, so you talked about the impact of positive and negative externalities on these speech codes, and whether you could talk about perhaps what some of the positive impacts would be of generally increasing the amount of speech available. Thank you.
Well, look, on the positive side, speech essentially is subject to a powerful amplification effect. So if you start looking to the transmission of information that is false, one of the famous lines about defamation is that the truth can never quite catch up to the lie, so that counter speech is not a sufficient memory. But on the other hand, suppose it turns out that you have somebody who's done something which is terrible, and somebody releases that information, which he did not obtain in confidence. Now, in effect, when he gets it out to everybody else in the world, the externalities are distinctly positive, because all sorts of people are now warned against dealing with people who are not fit and trustworthy in which to deal. So you'd like to be able to encourage the positive speech under those circumstances and to shut down the negative speech. And that is why, for example, if you're not talking about breach of confidential relationships, but you're talking about the revelation of truthful past information that are lawfully acquired, somebody knows that X had committed a crime a long time ago and now pretends to be a major citizen in the community, the release of that information, very difficult at common law in order to say that it's wrong because of that. Now, you do get privacy statutes, and these essentially can be obviously attacked on the grounds that what you do by forcing silence on these issues, by erasing the record, is you now create yourself a situation in which the person who goes ahead and commits fraud can get away with it because the counter speech is no longer there. And the counter argument that you have to then face is that this stuff was so long ago that there's some systematic behavioral bias that we all seem to suffer from, so that if you allow that information to come in, it will just overwhelm everything else and there'll be no way to correct against it. I do not think in principle you could rule out that justification, but at this point, you then generally come to the battle is how all-powerful are sort of behavioral explanations of one form or another to deviate from traditional common law rules. And I think the correct answer on that is a strong presumption against using those deviations unless it's clearly shown to be sensible. So in this particular case, it may well be that the way the thing shakes out is if it's 50 years ago or longer, okay, but if it's less than that, not. Or if it's related to the work that they're doing, it's not going to be something you could suppress. You might be able to find something like that. But in general, I would probably say that the common law rule on positive externality implies in those particular cases. When you're talking about contracts, if there's an ordinary contract of sale in which I sell goods to A, it turns out A is better off and I'm worse off. Some competitors may be disappointed, but they can do the same thing to me. And so long as we know that the economics in these arrangements is such that competitive equilibria are optimal, you don't want to shut this thing down. And the externalities are enormously positive because A, it means that other people entering into similar arrangements will get the same sort of legal protection. And B, it means that both of the parties to the transaction are better off than they were before, which systematically increases the opportunities for third parties. So positive externalities are what drive the case for competitive markets. On the other hand, if you have a contract between A and B to divide territories or to restrict output, the gains between the two parties are positive, but the externalities are systematically negative given the standard principles associated with monopoly. And the only question is whether or not you refuse to enforce the contract, or whether or not you actually have some antitrust-like sanction against it, because the sign of the externality has shifted. So in order to understand why simple transactions work, positive externalities provide an enormous justification, and you could do the same thing with various kinds of real estate transactions by people who improve the quality of their own quality, benefiting their neighbors. Generally speaking, it's impossible to make them pay for it, but you try to develop a series of social sanctions and informal customs which will encourage those sorts of behavior. One of the things I would just say in closing on this is the discussion of positive externalities as part of the overall system in both voluntary arrangements and in arrangements between strangers is something which tends to be understudied because the actual instantiation through suits for restitution is relatively narrow, while the suits for torts are relatively broad. But the phenomena are much more widely understood, and you have to figure out how it influences other transactions which generate those externalities in the first place. I think there's time for most one more question. One more question. Oh my God, I got two, but I'll take only one. Sir?
When it comes to speech, I'm actually curious as to what you believe about the secondary effects doctrine that came out of Renton versus the Playtime theaters.
Oh, Renton. I mean, look, this is one of the most difficult questions in the world. Renton is one of these cases where you're trying to figure out what you do with girly theaters of one sort or another, pornography shops, which are located in different neighborhoods. And let me first sort of indicate you the two preferred solutions for this to explain why it is that it's so difficult to solve. Solution number one is we want all of these places in something which we could call a red light or at least an orange light district. You cordon them off, you have them there, and all the God-fearing citizens don't have to worry about it. And the other theory is, what you really want to do is to spread these things around so that people don't congregate in one place, and if they find it hard to go from one to another, it's going to be difficult to set up a competitive market, and customers aren't going to be there. It's clear when you talk about diamonds, people tend to sell them in districts. So you get both of these theories. And they can't both be right. They can both be wrong, or it can be confusing. So what's my general view on this? Is unless you know what's going on, you don't want to impose strong kinds of spatial relationships. But what you try to do is to get other kinds of things, like the signage that they could put up, where they could put it up, the hours that they can open, whether or not they can serve liquor, which I think they could, whether or not they could serve minors, which I don't think they can, and so forth, where their entrances are located and things like that. Because you're much better off with those things which are unambiguous with respect to their consequences rather than those things are not. And if you read all of the cases, mini theaters and Renton together, what you do is you just throw up your hands because you can't figure out who's right. And so therefore what you try to do whenever you have that situation is don't invest your resources on basically a doubtful proposition. Invest it in the more modest things that you can do which are more likely to have positive effects. And since this conference has to end on a positive note, I will stop on the word positive effects, hoping that my remarks have had positive externalities galore to all of you. Thank you.